Welcome to the Men of 8 Gangcock podcast, episode 236. I'm Steve Borsch, and I'm on with Tim Elliott.
And we're poking cows down here in Lakeville.
Graham Thickens.
Good morning, guys.
And our buddy Phil Wilson is off. I don't know. He went down to Iowa to see his mom, right?
Yeah.
He's a good boy.
He is a good boy. He's a good son. Yeah.
He does have a lot of vices, but he still loves his mother. So that just makes up for all of his other vices.
Would you say he doesn't like the Vikings?
No, I said he has a lot of vices.
Oh.
But his love for his mother in Iowa just makes up for it. So all right. We salute you, Phil.
Yes. He's a good boy. Anyway. So there were no events this week, really.
Well,
right? We went to
Treehouse open house.
Yeah. That was a good one. We'll get to that in a couple of minutes, but did that Jamf software user event, did that happen this past week?
Yes.
I think so. Julio wrote a piece about it.
Okay.
Yeah, that was the big one. When you say there were no events, that's a biggie. They draw 700 or 800 people to that thing, I think. But it's a closed user group kind of a thing.
Right. Well, have you guys ever seen Jamf's software? And for those listening, it's JAMF, and they make software for essentially large scale Mac and iOS device management.
And they start out to making regular apps for Macs way back, you know, classic Mac apps. I mean, they've been in this business for a long time.
A very long time. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I went down to an event they had some time ago, and at that point, people were trying to figure out how do we get publications onto iOS devices, you know, custom publications that we're doing just for our company or just for our educational institution. And they had come up with a process to do it. And it wasn't, you know, violating any of Apple's terms of service or anything. And I just sat back and I thought, man, is that clever, the way that they'd pulled it off. And everybody was just tickled. So, I mean, that's the kind of innovation that they're doing, too, on top of it.
Yep. Yeah, they have a great group of developers, and they're very big in the university and education, probably K-12 and university level markets, right, Steve?
Yes, absolutely. Well, really anybody that's got, I don't know what they consider to be their floor, but I think it's probably, you know, 40 or 50 devices and above.
Yeah,
because under that, you know, you can do a lot of the stuff manually. You don't have to have some great big solution like Casper Suite, which is the name of their suite of tools. But good platform.
Yeah, it really is. And I don't know if Julio got to their event or if he wrote this story prior to the event, but it's nearly 250 people now downtown at Jamf Software.
Wow.
Started with a handful of guys in 2002, and now they're quite big with branch offices all over the place too, including in Cupertino.
Wow.
So, Steve, have you been to the Target Minnetonka store yet?
You know, I haven't, but you're kind of our resident retail analyst, and aren't they doing some kind of a test?
Yeah, they're testing a new electronics department that sort of is inspired by the Apple Store, kind of. And they have a picture in the story in the Business Journal. And it's out at the Ridgedale Center store is where they're testing it. And it looks pretty good.
Is this Minnetonka store, is a, they're calling it what, an Apple-flavored layout or something?
Yeah. Yeah, they're testing out a new layout. They have a picture in the Business Journal story. And it kind of looks a little Apple-y, but it's, you know, it's in a Target, so it's got that red Target flair to it as well.
Yeah.
But they're just organizing their electronic department a little bit more aggressively than they had in the past.
Hey, maybe they hired Ron Johnson to help him. I hear he needs a gig. Little consulting gig there with his old employer.
He walked out of there. I walked out of Apple with something like $50 million. So I'm sure he's okay.
Yeah. And I think he probably walked out with a lot of money from Penny too, though he bombed the stock big time.
But it just shows that, Apple's retail kind of strategy is trickling down into stores like Target now.
Yep. Right.
So I don't know. It's hard to tell from the picture. I thought you, since you live out that way, Steve, you might have dropped by the Ridgedale Center Target to see what it looks like live. But that's where they're testing.
I didn't. No.
All right. Well.
Huh.
But just another local thing to look at.
Yeah.
Is it really all that different than what Best Buy has done, though, too? I mean.
Not really.
You know, their stores have increasingly looked Apple flavored to me. Well, the computer part of their stores, I guess.
Well, and some of the Targets, there's one near us in Burnsville that has these little like mini Apple stores in them that are very much like the ones that were in Best Buy for years, you know, and still are the little Apple area that that's the little Apple-y tables and all the Mac and iPad stuff out there.
Yeah, so. Kind of the library table sort of thing. Yeah,
same kind of thing. So yeah.
Well, we're still having some audio issues, guys. So for those listening, we'll see if we can do a little troubleshooting here. But it's not too bad. So I think we'll just keep going here.
Thanks, Skype.
Yeah, I think it's Skype too.
Let's blame it on them.
Let's blame it on Skype. Hey, listen, you know what's interesting to me is the woman who is my dental hygienist. I went to high school with her husband, and he went to work for Stratasys about 2 years ago. And all she talks about is Stratasys and 3D printing, and she's saying, oh, my God, Jim just absolutely adores his job. And she's talking about how much fun he's having and he's traveling like crazy and he loves the space and blah, blah, blah. But mainly what she talks about is how he's duct taped himself to a rocket and how they're just exploding in growth.
Huh. What does he do for him?
He's in some kind of a business development area. Mm-hmm. And so he's spending a lot of time in Germany because I guess they have a big facility there. And so... I'm not exactly sure because he and I haven't connected for a while because he's traveling all the time.
I wonder if he works with MakerBot with Bree Pettis at all.
Yeah, I don't think so. I think because I don't know, but I think that they're still separate.
They're getting a lot of coverage in the local press,
and they deserve it because it's going to be one of those 21st century companies we're going to hear a lot about.
Well, what's funny is you're starting to see like mainstream crossover stuff with 3D printing. My wife was watching the finale of Project Runway the other night, and one of the designers had built some jewelry out of a 3D printer. So they designed it and then printed out a one-off, necklace thing. So it's even, crossing over into stuff like that where people are getting more... aware of what you can do with it.
Well, I just saw on, somebody posted an article about KSTP's article about 3D printing and Tenet company that is using it for prototypes. Mm-hmm. And then ironically, as I just came across in my news feed, an article about a pair of glasses, that have been printed by a 3D printer. And that the materials that they're using are so cured once it's dry that they're indistinguishable from normal run glasses frames. And they're plastic, of course. You're not going to make titanium glasses frames, but you can begin to see the hints of real production with 3D printing when you can essentially be able to make any style frame. And so it's interesting to see it move beyond the prototype stage. So I wonder how long that'll take.
Well, with glasses, though, you still need those little hinges and nose pads and things like that. So, You still have to have multiple parts and pieces to put together, you know.
Right.
I read a story with all the hype about 3D printers. Did you see that story a couple, 3 weeks ago? On that was basically, with all the hype, only 150 3D printers are sold per day or something like that.
Kind of really.
This kind of put it into perspective. And, you know, it was maybe citing numbers only for consumer 3D printers. I can't remember. But then again, there probably aren't too many of the $80,000 and $100,000 versions sold per day either. You know?
Right, right, right.
But the low end, what's the low end now? $1,200, you know, $999, you know, a lot of retailers, or not a lot, but certain retailers are starting to carry them. But how many they're moving at this point is, you know, it's apparently still pretty, you know, modest.
Yeah, but Tim, remember the conversation, and you brought up some of these points, and I brought up some of these points that we were having on the podcast about the analogies between 3D printing and desktop publishing, and how even though the LaserWriter came out and was this awesome, amazing $7,000 printer back in the late 80s, you know, it's not like printing presses went away. You know, there were service bureaus in between that would turn your digital files into film, and then
trade typography went away. That was a huge business, and it was completely replaced by laser printing. It took a while. It took 3 or 4 years, but this had been a trade that had been, you know, passed down from hot type days, you know, from when
Gutenberg, baby.
Yeah.
But I mean, from the Industrial Revolution, when they came up with the Linotype machines, where they, you know, basically cast lead into the molds to, you know, set each letter. So it came down from there, and it, you know, so it had like 100+ year run, and then that was replaced by what they call cold type, which is, you know, doing it on photographic paper, and that had gone on for probably 40 or 50 years. And then all of a sudden, laser printers came out, and within like 3 years, that entire industry was completely wiped out.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was huge kind of thing. And I think we're going to see something like that with the 3D printers.
Do you think it'll happen faster?
No, because it's different, because it's not just directly replacing something that took, you know, a relatively long time. To set type, you had to send your files to a type house, and it would take a day or two before it came back. And now, you know, you could do it immediately, and it would only take a few minutes.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's going to be something like that. And you know, in prototyping new products, I think that 3D printers, that's where it's going to really kind of shine. And I have to wonder, the guys that design cars in Detroit, if they're still, you know, making clay molds for that, or if they're just printing them out on 3D printers. I would imagine they would be shifting in that direction, since they design the cars on CAD anyway. So that would make
I think that a lot of them are making body parts. They're printing body parts and instead of clay molds.
Yeah,
and so they can make the full size vehicle. Yep. Yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
Well, it'll be interesting to see where this all ends up. But, you know, we talked earlier about the Treehouse event on Thursday night.
So, Graham, you've been working with these guys had the past?
Well, I had the opportunity to be involved in some of the discussions earlier this year, the planning stages of Treehouse. So, yeah, I'm certainly familiar with the model. It's a... they're calling it an innovation center, but it's a physical incubator located downtown in the Loring Park office building, and just officially opened Thursday night with a big reception. And
great space, by the way, the old Wilson facility. And oh my, I'll put some pictures in the show notes. It's amazing.
Yeah, I think it's 13,000 square feet.
Yeah.
And, you know, nice location, kind of on the edge of downtown. And And so it's off and running, and we'll be starting to announce portfolio companies or tenants that will be located there, one of which has been announced already, which we can mention later. But John Blank, who's a former practicing physician and a former United Healthcare executive, is the leader of this fine organization, along with his son, JD. Together, they are partners in an investment fund called Dalmore Investments. And John's been retired from United Health for, I think, a year or so, where he was a senior exec, a senior VP of Emerging Businesses Group, which was basically their venture capital arm.
And believe me, they know everybody and every company and every process in healthcare.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's, yeah.
Yep, it's a great background and obviously very well connected guy, having worked in the healthcare industry for many years in the managed care and services sector of the healthcare industry, as he says. So yeah, it'll be fun to bring him on and let's tell us a little more about it.
Yeah, let's give him a call.
The website is treehouse-health.com.
John?
Yes, hey, good morning.
Good morning, Steve Borsch and Graham Thickens and Tim Elliott.
Well, good morning, guys.
Hi, John.
Hi.
You must be feeling pretty good about that nice open house reception you had on Thursday night.
It was. It was. It's nice to actually kick off the opening for the Treehouse and have such a good turnout and such a diverse turnout, too, from brand new entrepreneurs to folks who've been in venture capital and investing for 30 or 40 years. So it was quite a nice group.
Yes, it was. Yeah. Well, tell us a little bit about, I'll throw out the first question. Why did you choose to launch something like Treehouse? Give us a little background.
Yeah, sure, Graham. If you think about and I guess anywhere somebody starts depends on where they stand a bit. So I, in my last job at United Health Group about 2 years ago, my responsibility was to help evaluate new startups that would or early stage companies that came to United seeking advice or business or investment. And in that regard, lots of companies come in who all had very good understanding of their own product and what they had done, but didn't seem to necessarily understand the healthcare marketplace and the various aspects of it. And that was understandable because it's a pretty complex organization, complex environment. So when we started Treehouse, the goal was to bring together folks who represented the different parts of healthcare, everybody from payers to providers to medical device makers to people in the consumer area, to try and get established companies to participate in an innovative environment with new startups and help guide them and help them to be successful. And so that was the goal of Treehouse, is to make our companies successful by helping them gain customers and grow their businesses.
Sure. And along the way, you met Joe Whitney, or maybe you already knew him, who was the owner of the building, and you chose that space to build out and modify to your needs.
That's true. Ironically, at the same time that we were talking about how do we create an innovative space for healthcare companies, particularly early stage healthcare companies, Joe was thinking about how does he create, take advantage of the space he has, which is rather unique and interesting, to also help support early-stage companies. And the two of us got together, and it seemed like our ideas matched. And the next thing you know, after 6 months of blood, sweat, and tears, the Treehouse was born.
Yeah, and it looked great. You know, I learned something the night I was there at the open house. Is not only was that space formerly the Olson Ad Agency space, but somebody said it used to be the Loring Playhouse. Is that true?
It was. It's gone through several iterations. It was the Loring Playhouse. In fact, the marquee for the Loring Playhouse is still outside. It looks such an interesting graphic. We didn't want to take it down. And it was also one of the first car dealerships in Minneapolis, actually. There's some pictures of it from the 20s that shows that sort of utilization of the space as well.
So, what a great history.
Yeah, it's a great space.
So are you going to be looking for, corporate partners or others that are going to be affiliated or doing partnering or alliances with Treehouse?
Yeah, we are actually in sort of there's three or four types of partners that will participate in the Treehouse. Certainly, there's our startup companies which we're trying to help grow, and doing whatever we can to make them successful. Secondly, there'll be large, more established healthcare companies who are interested in innovation and collaboration, who can lend their expertise and wisdom and counsel to some of these early startups. Thirdly, will be companies that can provide services, anything from curbside consults on legal issues and accounting issues to IT support and other things. And finally, there's a group of folks who are interested in investing in these companies, either angels or venture capital folks that specialize or are interested in early stage companies. So we're hoping to have that entire mix well represented at the Treehouse.
There's quite a bit of med tech already going on here in the Twin Cities. Are there any sectors that you'd like to truly kind of foster and grow more aggressively?
Yeah, I think there's two areas that are particularly up our alley in terms of the level of expertise we bring. And they relate to companies that focus on enhancing the care delivery and care coordination process. So that could be companies that do disease management or companies that help providers better manage individual types of diseases or the overall hospital process. And the second would be companies in healthcare IT, where there's, a tremendous boom in that area, actually in both areas, as a result of the challenges of health reform and the way it requires companies to start to rethink their business model.
John, how would you position Treehouse with respect to other similar sorts of initiatives? I mean, we hear a lot of talk about accelerators. We have for years now. And I know you're certainly not positioning it as an accelerator per se, but tell us what your positioning is, how it's different.
Sure. I think there's two or three differences, Graham. The first piece, I think, perhaps, is that most of the accelerators will have a class and bring in 15 to 20 companies for a period of 10 to 16 weeks and have that class work through a series of processes to get perhaps to funding ready or to get to finalize business plans, etc. We look at companies coming in as really companies we want to partner with. So we anticipate them being there anywhere from 6 months to 2 years. And don't view each of our companies we view as individuals. So what is it that they need? In fact, one of our selection criteria for companies is what can we provide to them that's different than just writing them a check, because we can certainly invest separately. The issue is how do we find companies that we can really help be successful.
Well, the idea of
a long-term thing as opposed to a class. And then I think the other major piece is we don't look at them as, we're not really looking at very early stage companies. We're looking at companies that have a clear understanding of their product or service. They may be pre-revenue or early stage revenue, but their real focus is on growth.
That's a main difference from typical accelerator programs, which are almost exclusively about very early stage companies. So, okay, go ahead, Steve.
No, I was just going to say, John, that when you and I touched on some of the business intelligence that you guys can bring to emerging companies or even startups, whether it's what database and mailing list to buy, to what tools to use to market to different segments, and even to understand different segments. I think that is just huge because it can really burn up a lot of cycle times when you're trying to develop a product or service and you aren't really sure how to target it.
But, it makes a huge difference. And surprisingly, I was continually surprised when I'd see companies come in to talk to me previously, and I'd ask them, well, how do you think this impacts, you know, HIPAA impacts this? And they'd get a look on your face like, HIPAA, what's HIPAA got to do
with
this?
No.
Not really an understanding that personal health information is much more than just what's your blood pressure. And you can get into that piece fairly quickly. The other is, it surprised me that people who manipulate data around healthcare don't necessarily understand that there's a very slippery slope that gets you quickly into FDA regulation. And if you don't understand these things, you can go down a path for a long time, only to find that you have to retrace your steps and figure out a better model.
So you'll be able to provide some guardrails in terms of, hey, just don't go get too close to that guardrail.
That's true.
Yeah.
Say, one other thing I think that is worth calling out is, you are certainly not going to be limiting yourself to looking at companies that are only necessarily founded in Minnesota, right? Is it true that a major advantage for startup tenant companies would be the chance to relocate here and get it to be part of the Minnesota healthcare ecosystem, right?
Oh, that's absolutely true. We're actually in discussions now with companies from Canada, companies from Ohio, company from New Jersey, and another one from California, all of whom were in early stages talking to figure out how can we add value and whether it makes sense. But it seems to them, at least at first blush, it seems like it might make sense to relocate to Minnesota.
Sure. And how many of this is kind of a forward question, I guess, is a year from now, how many startup portfolio companies, tenants of Treehouse would you like to have? What's sort of a rough goal?
You know, this gets back to a little bit about our model of being true partners with the folks that are at Treehouse, rather than just providing space or running 25 of them through a business plan exercise. The net of that is that we want to be relatively limited. So 10 to 15 companies at any point in time.
Sure.
We believe that between myself, my partners, and the other experts who are willing to participate with us, we can provide true, meaningful support and help to between 10 to 15 companies. More than that, and I think it becomes diluted, and you're not able to do as much for any one.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Steve, you had a good question about...
About the startup scene?
Well, about healthcare startup. Our healthcare startup scene and funding in general.
Yeah, I have my own answer, but I'm just curious what you think, because you're obviously in a game, playing the game at a much different level than any of us are. But BioEnterprise came out with a report about the Midwest healthcare venture investments and seemed to indicate, or did indicate, that it showed investment was falling in the Midwest, especially in Minnesota, had fallen somewhat. And I'm wondering if that was really all about the uncertainty in, the Affordable Care Act and whether or not there'd be taxes on medical devices and so on, or if there's some other reason that we're not seeing.
You know, I think it's a little bit misleading if you just look at dollar volume. And the reason I say that is, if you look at much of the historical medical development in the Twin Cities has been around med devices. And med devices, as regulation has gotten more and more complex, the issue of the tax might have something to do with it as well. When you look at investing in a med device company these days, you have to be looking at something in the $5 to $10 million range at a minimum, and very probably 5 to 8 years to get to fruition. And I think there has been probably a decrease in the folks interested in participating in those sorts of early stage companies. Now, contrast that with what I believe is the explosion is you're looking at things around healthcare IT, as well as companies in the care delivery and care coordination space, the ACO space. Those areas, I think, are booming. But by the same token, part of the reason they're booming is because the cost to entry is relatively small. So you can have 15 new startups in the health IT space, and the amount of dollars invested is less than one medical device startup. So you see a somewhat skewed approach if all you're doing is looking at dollar volume.
Yeah, that's good insight, John. Well, you know, we should probably wrap, but as a final question, I just or comment I wanted you to make. You did announce your first portfolio company. You want to say a few words about that?
Yeah, sure. Our first portfolio company is River Systems. The CEO is Joel Ackerman. Joel and I first met each other, mid-90s, I guess, when we both worked for United Healthcare. But I haven't seen Joel in a long time, and he's spent time developing a rather innovative and creative way to link communities, particularly rural communities, but it could be anywhere, for helping seniors age in place and providing them with access to a variety of community services as well as healthcare opportunities. So we're excited about that, and Joel's moved in, and he'll be joined shortly with a few more folks, and that'll be fun to have more activity and people running around the treehouse.
Sure, and the solution is called HomeStream, right?
Yep. Yeah, I'm particularly interested in this. My dad was 87, and we kept him in his house to the end, and I'm acutely aware of some of the issues surrounding aging in place and the fact that there's not enough capital to build retirement homes for everybody, and I'm very interested in what River Systems is doing.
Really creative and has some great opportunities. Their first pilot is down in Yedling, Minnesota, and that seems to be going quite well. So I'm very enthusiastic about Joel.
So if entrepreneurs are interested in pitching you, they should go to treehouse-health.com and make an inquiry?
That would be great. They can also follow us on Twitter at Treehouse Health. And we'll continue to try and help energize and take advantage of the great opportunities in the healthcare startup area.
You bet, John. Great. Well, thanks so much for being on with us.
Yeah,
we appreciate it.
Thank you guys.
Yeah, and best of luck as you go forward. I'm sure the nice facility will be filling up nicely here going over the next several months.
Oh, yes. I think we'll have a good time for a Christmas party.
You bet. Great.
All right.
Thanks, John.
Take care.
Thank you, John. Bye.
Well, that sounds like a great direction for them.
Yep. And it's a powerful group of folks that formed this and that he has on the board, you know, very well connected folks in the community, obviously. And John and his son, JD, who is executive director, John is chairman of Treehouse. They've had experience making angel investments out of their own fund, Dalmore Investments. And obviously we'll continue to be doing that going forward. I think the initial amount, well, I'm not sure what the initial amount they invest in each startup accepted into Treehouse.
I thought it was 25 grand.
I think it is 25K. Yeah. And then they get free rent for as long as they need it, you know, based on each individual situation.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not a 3-month thing. It can be a year or even more in some cases. And
well,
so
I gotta tell you that, and I'm no expert on the healthcare space by any stretch of the human imagination, but when I did this study of the under 100 bed hospital space and discovered that hospitals overall, now I know that's just one segment of healthcare, but hospitals overall, the average gross margin is 2.8%. And the under 100 bed market, which is majority of hospitals, is under 2% as gross margin. And you figure, man, oh man, you make one hiccup and that's it. You know, you're starting to lose money. And, but then you look at all the spaces. I mean, you know, medical education and training and devices and diagnostics. And of course the Internet of Things and electronic health records. I mean, there's so many places that, frankly need disruption and need innovation to either radically cut costs or to radically improve the delivery side or you know, et cetera, et cetera. It's like, there's just, I mean, how could you not just look around and see opportunity everywhere?
Yeah, really. Well, and you know, and he mentioned rural communities and so forth. There's a lot of work being done in rural healthcare in the state. And from what I've learned over hanging around with some of these people over the last several months is I think Minnesota is a leader in that area.
Yeah.
In rural healthcare, and as it is in so many other aspects of healthcare. So, you know, it's a pretty amazing ecosystem here, as John alluded to, and this is trying to bring it together where you know, both startups and larger corporate partners mixing in with startups can kind of benefit society as a whole here, you know, in our own population and beyond. So yeah, it's a pretty neat initiative, and I'm happy they were able to get it launched and off and running now, and I'm sure we'll be hearing more about it.
Yep. And that you were able to have bacon wrapped scallions.
Oh, scallops.
Scallops at the event.
Those bacon wrapped scallops. Oh, I wanted to fill my pockets and go home with those things.
Well, you should have. You should have brought some for Tim. Hey, Tim.
Yeah, I like scallops.
Yeah. I have a question for you. So did you see this? And there have been several people's take on the announcement, but that, you know, obviously Android from a market share standpoint is completely dominant in the smartphone space, but that Apple's iOS earns much more money for Apple than Android earns for Google.
Yep.
So, I mean, and it is interesting because, I mean, I've asked developers over and over again. So when you look at who to develop for, who do you develop for? Well, you get one answer from the game developers, you know, who want to, especially if they're going to do a free game. But then also if anybody has an app that they want to sell, they choose iOS first.
Well, I think that's changing because of the market share difference. I think many developers are either developing for Android first or they're, you know, timing their app to be Android almost at the same time it comes out on iOS.
Got it. Okay.
That hit piece that Graham sent out around, you know, points out a lot of the problems that Android has. But if you look at the business model of Apple and Google, they're radically different. The reason that Google did what they did with Android was not to make money on Android. They've created this ecosystem. And actually Samsung makes a lot of money on Android. More money than probably Google does, a lot more, I'm sure. But Android enables Google to still have a advertising platform in the mobile space, which is what they want. That's where they, you know, they clearly make more money.
Right.
So that's why they did it, because Apple, I mean, they were an early partner of Apple with the iPhone, and you know, Apple just wouldn't work with them the way that Google needed to work on the advertising piece. Apple wanted it for themselves. So that's why the Android kind of, you know, program was developed. And it was never developed to make a lot of money in it on its own. So I think it's been very successful, and it's matured into a platform that's, you know, as good as iOS is. You know, it's very, very useful to have two platforms that play off each other, that push each other.
Oh, I totally agree.
I think iOS is better for it. That's for sure.
Well, I also think that Google's doing okay, seeing as how their stock broke $1,000 yesterday. It's like, oh my God. I just kicked myself. Of course, I didn't have available cash. I was so freaked at the, you know, in the December of 2008, when Apple had dropped to like $86 a share, and I had, you know, way too much Apple. And my wife and I actually talked about selling some, and I think Google was like not too much more than that, maybe 101 or something. And I thought, God, if I had some cash, I'd buy some Google too. Well, of course, hindsight's always 20/20, but holy buckets.
Yeah.
That's pretty amazing.
But you know, that $1,000 thing, yeah, it sounds cool, but you know, that means it's up 1,100% from its IPO.
Yeah.
Apple is up 3,300% from its IPO. So, you know, I bought some Google at like 400 and I sold it at 500 and I'm not sorry I sold it.
Yeah.
But I'm really happy I hung on to Apple through all this time. So, you know, the $1,000 milestone, yeah, you know, it's not too many stocks trade at that level, but
well, that's
but,
why
you know, you do have to put it in perspective.
Well, and that's why I love the rule number one for investing. Bears make money. I can't remember now. Something about bulls make money and bears, or bulls and bears make money and pigs get slaughtered. Is that what it is?
Something like that. Yeah.
Sorry.
Well, and the other rule is
a long way to go for that.
You never have to be, you know, you never have to be sorry for taking a profit, or, you know, there's absolutely nothing wrong with taking a profit on a stock. You're never going to guess the highs and the lows anyway. So,
yeah,
you know, buy stuff you like and hang on to it. That's what I did originally with Apple, you know.
Well, now
I'm going to do with Twitter if I can.
Well, and now I'm starting to see articles about Microsoft and how Microsoft will end up being the most valuable company in the world, you know, in this decade. And I don't see how, but
because of Nokia
or Windows 8.1.
But yeah, apparently it's a lot better than Windows 8 from the review. I haven't had any personal experience with it, but you know, it's intriguing. Windows 8 is an intriguing idea, and they've clearly gotten to that converged OS where it's mobile and desktop is the same sort of place that Apple is moving toward. They've got their first, and it, you know, there's a few bugs here and there, but you know, it's getting fairly well reviewed. But the problem is that people that are long-term Windows users, like my father is a good example. He calls me, you know, and says, how do I do X? How do I do Y? And he's never called me about anything with Windows before Windows 8.
Yeah.
So Windows 8 is such a dramatic change that, you know, long-term Windows users that have used it since Windows, you know, 3.1 can't figure out how the thing works. And you know,
well, but
that's
not good. But Tim, that's my issue. So our accounting computer is Windows. And we bought
it. Hopefully you're running Windows 7 on it.
Well, we were on the old one. We bought a new one and you could only buy them with 8. And so we ended up, I did some workarounds so that when you boot it up and you log in, it takes you to the desktop. And then I put a third party start button in there and all that. But if you make one click in the wrong place, you're brought back to the tiled Windows 8 interface. And right. I got to tell you, I sat down on a Saturday when I was installing the stuff on the new computer, and played with Windows 8 for I'd say maybe 3 hours, and I still don't really get it. I don't really understand the interface and why they chose to do this in this way. I mean, I'd like to have a switch that I could just flip, and it would be Windows 8 with a Windows 7 like user interface. Or you can have the tiled interface, but not both, because it's not intuitive. And everybody that I know that has Windows 8 is just like your dad. I mean, even young people, even people in their 20s are like, what the you know, what WTF is this? Seriously. Yep. I mean, it's amazing to me.
And they want to get back to that desktop look. And so this week I said, check for Windows 8.1. You'll get the upgrade. Upgrade as quickly as you can because they brought back, you know, a reasonably good desktop view.
Yeah.
And they've made it so you can go in, you know, the way that you normally would. So it opens up not to those tiles, but to, you know, the desktop. And they brought back the start button.
Right.
Or a version of the start button, you know. Start
menu. So the message is sell MSFT or buy MSFT.
I don't know, because what they're doing is very interesting, but it hasn't caught on at all. And I would think that they would have an opportunity in the enterprise to sell Windows phones. And they still haven't like completely trounced RIM yet. From what I'm seeing is that everybody that I know that works at a, you know, big name company that used to have a BlackBerry now has an iPhone. they're not going to Windows Phone.
Yeah.
You know? So it's like these big companies that are migrating off of BlackBerries are going to iPhones.
Well, and this guy listens to the shows. That's the
business that Microsoft should have, you know, given their dominance in the enterprise.
Well, so this guy listens to the show, and so I'm not going to say his name, but he is in, he's a fairly high level guy in technical support, running support for a fairly large organization here in town. Yes, I'm being nebulous. But anyway, he was talking about
BlackBerry user, right?
No, he was talking about rollouts of Chromebooks because they're a Google Apps organization.
Yep.
And I said, wait, what? I mean, how can people possibly be productive? You know, and he looked at me and he goes, you know, you're using everything Google, you know, all the things you can do. And he said, 95% of our users don't need pivot tables and spreadsheets. They don't need very, very sophisticated PowerPoint capability. And he said for 90% for sure of our users, a Chromebook would be perfect. And in our tests, it's radically reduced support costs.
Yeah. Well, I'm in the market for a new laptop. My MacBook Pro is, you know, showing its age. I mean, it's like 6 years old, so I need an upgrade. And, you know, looking at the upgrade paths, you know, I've got, you know, minimum of $1,000 to get into a new MacBook. And I'm seriously looking at Chromebooks. And my son just upgraded, and he was going to get a, you know, crappy Windows laptop for, you know, $300 or whatever.
Yeah.
I said, hey, go in to Best Buy and take a look at that Samsung Chromebook that Julio had a review, you know, like 6-8 months ago, whatever.
Yeah.
On it. And he looked at it, and he said, it's fantastic. And he bought it, you know, for $250.
Oh, you're kidding.
Oh. No, and he loves it. He's, you know, he's very embedded in the Google Apps, as I am too, and I know you are too, Steve.
Yeah.
So it's like, it just works, and it works great for what he wants to do. He doesn't. The only thing he keeps a laptop around for, a full fledged laptop, is to sync his iPhone, and iPod with. That's it. So.
But you can do that with iCloud now if you want to pay for a little storage, but. But, you know, the other thing, too, is, you know, there are certain jobs, you know, especially creative jobs. If you're doing publishing or you're doing a lot of photo and imaging work, I mean, you need stuff like Aperture or Lightroom. You know, so there are a lot of tasks. It depends on what you do. So, I mean, I do video editing. I do screencasts. I do a lot of photo work. I'm using Photoshop all day, every day, you know, yada, yada, yada. And so
pro for that.
Exactly.
Too.
Yeah.
But you can just open up a Chrome screen sharing from Starbucks on your Chromebook, and you've got a Mac Pro.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
So I think it's a good you know, alternative for people, and it's much better than buying a crappy Windows laptop. I mean, the build quality in that Samsung is almost as good as a MacBook. And, you know, it's a quarter of the price of the entry level MacBook, so it's, you know, it's a lot less. And I put the story in the show notes because I also put in the event at the TIES event that we talk about every year,
mm-hmm.
Educational event that's in December, and it just got me thinking about, you know, education. And down here in Lakeville, you know, a couple years ago, they went to iPads, and, you know, they use iPad 2s, and those are, you know, they paid, I think, $500 each for them, or whatever the deal was when you buy, you know, several thousand.
Well, it would have been better than that.
But now I'm thinking, if you're going to make the same decision today, wouldn't you go for these Chromebooks? Because they're for what kids need to know to be successful today. Wouldn't something with a web browser, you know, and a keyboard be a kind of a better solution than an iPad?
Well, it would be, except a lot of the schools, and I know this because of the amount of time I spend in Eden Prairie schools. One of the number one concerns is local area network traffic. And so if you've got every kid with a Chromebook, every kid is going to be interacting online. And even if you have a lot of this stuff that, you know, is proxy served or whatever, you still got tremendous load on the network. And especially if you're, you know, that's why they eliminate YouTube and Vimeo and all the video sites, because they don't want these kids watching videos, because it just slams the network, and then the teachers can't do something if they're teaching. And so that's the only thing that people are running into that are responsible for these rollouts. But the thing that intrigues me, and you touched on it, Tim, is the screen sharing through the browser. And, you know, Google is the one who's really been driving WebRTC, the real-time communications open standard. And I'm seeing WebRTC being disruptive for Skype screen sharing, for WebEx and GoToMeeting, and really being a pretty phenomenal interface for audio, video, and screen sharing that just works in a browser. And it's a standard.
It's free.
And it's free, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it takes a little bit to set up, but once you get it set up, it works great. I agree with you.
Yeah, yeah. So
I don't know. I may buy Chromebook. I may buy this HP one, although I'm a little dubious. HP, not the greatest quality. I still may stick with the Samsung. We'll see. I'm waiting for the ones that have Haswell processors to come out, because I think that
Tuesday is the rumor.
Yeah, though, because the battery life will be like ridiculous on that. Can you imagine? I think they're gonna, you know, these new MacBooks that come out. I'll bet you that they'll get like 2 days of battery on with the Haswell processor, because they're getting what, like 10, 12 hours right now.
Right, right.
It'll be like 24 hours, I think. It'll be this phenomenally ridiculous. Which is funny, because I remember the first laptop I had was a 250 or 286 DOS. It ran DOS. and I carried like 3 or 4 batteries with me, because it would run for like an hour and a half each one. Remember those days, Steve?
Oh, God. I remember going to...
This is before the PowerBook came out, because I would have stayed back.
So I remember taking Mac 2CI color monitor, keyboard, mouse, and pushing a great big gigantic Sony 3-gun projector into Medtronic for an event, so I could project the computer up on the screen. It's like, oh my God. It took like 97 years to tweak it and get it ready, and oh my God.
Yeah. So next week, another Apple event. I'm sure we'll have Julio on next weekend to talk about whatever they announce.
But, we should.
Looks like some new Macs. Looks like new iPads, obviously.
Yep. Apple TV is a
rumor.
Thing there, really. I could see maybe a new puck coming out. You know, with a new processor, maybe a better processor. I just don't see them doing a whole lot with that.
Well, and I read they're talking an SDK for developers for Apple. Well,
that would be huge if they did that. Yeah.
Yep. Right. Well, then OS X Mavericks.
Yeah. True.
Will potentially ship. I've been playing with iWork for iCloud, and I loved Julio's report on that too. iWork for iCloud works really well. I mean, I'm really surprised about how good it is. Hey,
that work in the Chrome browser?
So, no issues,
because I've only used it with Safari. But if it works in the Chrome browser on that Chromebook, that should work. Huh. Wow, that would be crazy, wouldn't it? To use iWork on a Chromebook.
Yeah, that would be funny. No, but it works perfectly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Since I use Chrome exclusively. Hey, by the way, just an FYI, if you have Google Hangouts for iOS, anybody listening. They just added voice calling and Google Voice integration in the Google Hangouts app. And you can actually make voice calls and receive calls and stuff like that right through the Google Hangouts app. So that's really what they're pushing toward, is their unified communications application is Hangouts. It's all about Hangouts now.
Be going away, but all of their, their services will go through Hangouts.
Right. Right.
Did you read about that on Google Plus then? Or I'm kidding. I'm kidding.
I really need to spend more time there. I'm actually getting a lot of followers that are people that I like and I'm following back. And so it feels like more and more people are discovering Google Plus. So who knows? Maybe it'll happen.
Well, I saw a chart, and the traffic numbers aren't very good as far as referring traffic. You know, it's still Facebook, Pinterest, and Twitter are the top three, and Google Plus is way down the list.
Yeah,
but you know, it's coming.
I put on a few new events coming up, and one that I just didn't see, which I should have put on weeks ago, is Product Camp, which
it's
today, right?
Fifth year. It's today down at St. Thomas. Uh-huh. And when I put it on this morning, there were still like 36 or so tickets left. So for those rare people that listen to this show the day it comes out, you can still get tickets and go down to it.
Yeah, yeah, yep. Yeah.
I'll have to look for that next year because it's, you know, it's every October sometime it comes out.
Yep.
Yep. Then, that's a product manager guru event. They do a really good job with that.
And CityCamp MN.
Yeah, that's sort of like a conference for doing civic projects, you know, IT projects.
Nice.
That benefit the local community.
Well, I'll tell you what, I've been very, very impressed by some of the Drupal distributions that I've seen for government, and also some are bundling up WordPress installs with themes and plugins that are all vetted and all coordinated and orchestrated and all that. So it's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that should be good. And then I as I mentioned before, the TIES Education Technology Conference, December 14th. And
excellent.
It also goes to this. So it's the 14th, which is what, a Saturday. And then I think it's Tuesday, or maybe it's from Saturday until Tuesday. I think that's what it is.
Okay.
But I put in the website so people can check that out. But that's always a big event.
Yeah, it is.
Focusing K through 12, right?
It is. And it's also, you know, goes back to the days of the Minnesota Educational Computing Consortium, MEC, that became a corporation. But Minnesota's really always been looked at as at the minimum, a true thought leader in educational technology. Mm-hmm. And so that's why, I think that's why this conference is so well done. And it is Minnesota-centric, but people come in from certainly the surrounding five-state area, and I'm sure nationally as well.
So. And TIE is not to be confused with the TIE organization, which holds an annual EduTech event.
Right.
That's a different event.
Yep.
But similar names.
Absolutely.
All right.
Well, thanks, everybody, for listening to
the Minivate Gang podcast.
Alrighty. Take care, guys.
See ya. Gonna go watch me some football.